Hi, and welcome to the latest episode of Consilio's Better Places podcast, where I'm absolutely delighted today to be joined by Peter Freeman, who is chairman of the Cranebridge Growth Company. Peter, thank you very much for joining us.
Hello, great pleasure.
Thank you very much, Zen, for giving up your time today. I'm sure many in our audience will be aware of your background in the industry, but maybe just a quick one-minute précis maybe of how you started Argent and what it's kind of led to in your career.
A mere 44 years ago, age 25, I started a development company with my brother. Our first development was 4,000 feet in Southampton. That's the size of a biggish house. Our last development really was King's Cross in London, which was 8 million feet, and 2,000 times the first. Yeah. But Cambridge is a challenge even beyond that.
Well, indeed. And before we got to Cambridge, you were also chair of Homes England.
I was indeed.
2020. What was your kind of day-to-day role there at Homes England?
It was non-exec chair as opposed to an exec chair. And Homes England is an extraordinary vehicle. I think it really does an enormous amount of good as the government's housing and regeneration agency, stretching across lots of programmes like the Affordable Housing Programme, where we're the principal grant giver to housing associations, or the Housing Infrastructure Fund, which helps open up large sites which aren't viable without somebody paying for a new dual carriageway link or whatever. We make loans to big house builders, small house builders. When it's the big ones, it's specifically to open up large sites. We take equity in ventures. We supported modern methods of construction. So it's a fantastic cross-purpose vehicle, and it has 8 regional offices so that we can be close to the mayors and the local authorities where the action is.
Brilliant. In 2024, you stood down as the non-exec chair and became chair of the Cambridge
Company? Stood down in April 25.
Okay.
I did both jobs for a year.
Wow, okay. I didn't realise there was a crossover. Many hats.
Then they finally found somebody much better than Pat Ritchie, who's been chair since the beginning of May, and I've concentrated full-time on Cambridge since then.
What excited you about the Growth Company offer or the tap on the shoulder to say, Peter, is this something you would be interested in doing? What made you, after you said for over 40 years, in the industry, it's a fresh new challenge. What's exciting about it for you?
As somebody who spent most of my career in the private sector, you have to go where there is opportunity, and that means partly a site that's opportunity, but partly where there's demand. And there is a lot of demand for Cambridge. It's hot. But there's also a lot of problems at Cambridge. Mm-hmm. There's a shortage of water. There's a transport crisis. There's sure to be a power crisis. And I thought that if the government was prepared to really back Cambridge with funds and a long-term policy, there would be a chance to resolve those infrastructure problems and in many respects do some ideal development. You know, a lot of people are kind enough to say that King's Cross is exemplary and it mixes uses. It's not just offices or just housing or just education. It's all of them, and it's a place for the public. And Cambridge is clearly a place for the public. There's already lots of people living there, lots of people who want to visit it. It's got a global brand, not just as an extraordinary place to visit with loads of beautiful buildings going back hundreds of years, but as a place that has produced 125 Nobel Prizes, 24 unicorn businesses. But most of the big projects there are in some way slightly stuck. That, you know, whether you call it market failure or too many landowners or too little money for infrastructure or who's going to go first and cut the Gordian knot, there are problems. And I think the Growth Company can act as a kind of friend, reasoner, convener, provider of money. The money will be on commercial terms, because if the government is investing in the southeast, it really ought to get the money money back to the taxpayer. But it will help unlock situations, and hopefully the kind of rules we can set for intervening mean that the developments that are produced are infrastructure-led, they're mixed-use, they're placemaking. They're not just monoculture of estate housing or monoculture of estate business park.
Yeah, so would Water Beach Station be an example of how government / Homes England / the Growth Company can kind of get involved to unlock sites which are stalled?
So Water Beach Station is kind of business as usual for Homes England. There was a need to move the station from one side of Water Beach Village into the kind of growth area centre where the old airfield was. And nobody could really front the money for the station amongst the landowner developers, because they are putting in their own kind of on-site infrastructure, and at the sort of relatively slow sales rates, they can't fund it up front. So Homes England has made a kind of loan in order to pay for the infrastructure. It's absolutely.
Brilliant. So in the public appointment letter that was made public when you were inviting you to become chair, there were four priorities listed. Accelerating development, creating an infrastructure-first growth plan, which we've touched upon, leading cross-government efforts to unblock constraints, and overseeing the Cambridge Growth Company's business plan. Now, I'm sure all four are important and interlinked, but is there something that you decided to focus on right at the start, this is a priority, or has everything been kind of tackled at the same time in parallel?
I mean, I sort of make a comparison to King's Cross. There were several foundational documents at King's Cross, and no one of them would have done without the other.
Yeah.
There had to be a master plan to say kind of where things went and what the mix was. There had to be a kind of corporate governance to say who would get to make decisions, both on the one hand being able to make decisions to drive things forward, and on the other hand not being able to make arbitrary decisions that other people would regret.
Yeah.
Then there had to be where's the money coming from and the business plan. And the reality is, if the three of those things don't totally speak to each other, it won't succeed. So at Cambridge, our first job really is to work out how much beyond what's been envisaged in the emerging local plan is realistic for take up. So in a sense, it has to be demand driven. This isn't about building empty space or the government creating jobs in a place where there's no demand. It's about calculating what realistically, if there weren't restraints in terms of water or transport or power and environmental constraints, what might the demand be? Where might it best go? Which will need looking very closely at transport, because the road system isn't good, and it's difficult because it's a very ancient, beautiful city in the centre, and you can't take city through the centre. And whereas many central business districts are what they say, they are in the centre, in Cambridge it's already spread a long way round, partly because of the constraints in the centre. So there's, science parks growing to the north, the east, the south and the west, and it's a sort of big and complicated decision which will take quite a few months and a lot of research to decide.
So infrastructure first growth plan, does that mean that you are focused on unlocking from Treasury, unlocking from transport, that the funding for the big infrastructure changes was needed to get people to the jobs which you're creating? Is that really the focus of the growth company?
I think the focus is all working out what's needed, talking very closely to the locally elected politicians and the local officials, because they've been worrying about what needs to be done in Cambridge for a lot longer than I have, and are much closer to it. And then trying to put a business plan to them and the Treasury, saying, this is the way these things, which are public goods and public benefits and necessary if the government wants the growth in Cambridge, can be financed.
Yeah. So it was said in the first few months after your appointment, you couldn't go to an event in Cambridge about Peter Freeman being there. You certainly took on the listening mode, as you said you were going to do. You said you were going to go and listen, and it was self-evident that you were out there in listening mode. What did you learn in those first three, 4 months following appointment?
Probably the first thing I learned is how incredibly joined up Cambridge is, and sort of welcoming and very, very professional. So whether you talk to the politicians of different parties, and there's every party
in
the Cambridge constellation, or whether you talk to the kind of leaders of the university or the kind of local business people, they all know each other. And if you leave one meeting and go to the next meeting, the time you get there, they probably know what you discussed at the last meeting because they're all ring around. But I think on the whole, that's a really positive characteristic.
And you've tapped into that, I guess, with the advisory council, which consists of the leaders of CAMS, South CAMS, the mayor. Obviously, we had a recent change in mayoralty. I understand that's carried on from Pete Johnson to Paul Bristow, and independent experts as well from university and so on. What is their role within the Cambridge Growth Company?
So, I mean, at the moment, the Cambridge Growth Company doesn't have any statutory powers.
Right.
So it's a kind of convening, listening, recommending organisation. Mm-hmm. It has now commissioned what's called the evidence base.
Yes.
And it's probably important to sort of talk about the emerging local plan and the evidence base, because there's two reasons to address that. One is, why are you commissioning yet more
evidence? It has been asked.
Haven't the locals already done that? And of course they have. But they have commissioned it in the context of historic take-up and existing constraints that may not be able to be lifted.
Mm-hmm.
And we are commissioning it in a context of, if you could lift the constraints, would there be more demand?
Mm-hmm.
And what would it cost to lift the constraints? And will the extra demand being built up, in effect, justify and finance that? There's more sort of front view rather than rear view. So partly the role of the advisory council is to have the four political leaders in the room as we begin to sort of think things out and say, you know, would you prefer to go east or north or south or west, or, you know, what are your priorities? And partly within the advisory council, there's also Paul Leinster, who is kind of like an acknowledged national expert in the water situation, but lives in that area, was chair of a housing association in that there, and chairs Water Resources East. So we got really on the most sort of thorny problem apart from transport, we've got the top man in the room. We've had the vice chancellor for innovation in the room, since the whole project is not ultimately about housing numbers. The housing the housing numbers are critical to the government, and they're 1.5 million. But in Cambridge, the real question is economic growth, and the housing numbers go with the economic growth rather than the housing numbers being a thing in their own right. So we've had the vice chancellor, and then we have Baroness Sally Morgan, who is Master of College, has been close to Labour politics since the days of Tony Blair's number 10, and chairs the Hospital Trust. So the Hospital Trusts are kind of doubly important, partly because of the importance of the NHS and medical care for the population, but also because life sciences is, one of the key drivers, along with artificial intelligence and robotics and aeronautics in Cambridge. Yeah. But the cluster around Adam Brooks Hospital is second to none.
It's world leading, isn't it? World leading. Yeah. So would it be too simplistic to say what kind of you're looking to do? So if we can sort the water out, if we can sort the transport out, and if we can sort the energy out, this is what Cambridge could be. And you're going to government with, this is what you need to do, X, Y, Z. And if we do, wow, Cambridge can become this. Whereas the local plan is a bit more less grandiose, I guess, and more grounded.
I mean, it's like all local plans, it's grounded in saying, what are the needs and are we allocating enough land?
Statutory duty to produce it.
And in a sense, we're trying to jump beyond that, saying the needs, the demand could be greater than the historic needs, and the end product could be greater socially, commercially, for people already living there, for people coming there, than just an incremental increase in the size of the town. And I mean, the sort of things, you know, the new mayor is very keen on mass rapid transport, which historically was not financially viable. But if you kind of cast your mind forward and say, no, we're really changing the scale of the town, it probably does become affordable. And so, you know, part of the role of the growth company is to be that bridge between shorter term pressures of you've got to have a 5-year land supply to a longer term view of what can the city become.
So you've appointed a multidisciplinary team to create the development strategy. When is that going to be published? Is it early next year? That's what people are saying. Is that accurate?
Yeah. I mean, the multidisciplinary team was only appointed in February. It's led by Bureau Happold and Prior and Partners.
Yep.
It's a pretty kind of A-lister group. And I think they will do a great job. And we are encouraging as much kind of pooling of knowledge and sharing on the way with the combined local authority.
Yep.
But until it's sort of dangerous prejudging anything before it's finished. And I think the transport piece will be key.
Yeah. The geographical remit is something a lot of people are asking open questions about in respect of Cambridge is so much more than Cambridge. Yeah. And Cambridgeshire is certainly so much more than Cambridge. The city itself is actually quite tightly defined geographically. Yeah. So just having the remit to the city would probably be too small. But then how far do you spread out? So what is the current remit if you see a growth company to fall within this?
Yeah. So and Cambridge, you know, is historically the county city, but it's also actually kind of on the edge of the county. Yes. So West Suffolk and Uttlesford and Essex and Hertfordshire all kind of a stone's throw away. I think the only thing I'd probably say at this stage is you can't boil the ocean. To deliver this well will take incredible focus.
Yeah.
There will probably be at least 10 projects with it that are worth at least $3 billion each.
Wow.
So, and that's if you just stick to the kind of city and South Cambridgeshire boundaries. So I think it would be very odd to go beyond Cambridge County. You know, clearly there's relationships to places like Haverhill and West Suffolk, and we would work with the West Suffolk folk on looking at transport between them and, you know, jobs being shared.
It's good for Haverhill to be connected better with Cambridge in terms of how everything can link together.
But I don't think we should seek to have a kind of legal statutory responsibility for anything outside Cambridgeshire.
So what is the current legal statutory responsibility? Again, there's I wouldn't say confusion, but people are asking the open question about a potential development corporation being established. Are you able to provide any, at this stage, any further information on that?
So part of the evidence-based work is to actually look at what things need to be solved and what conditions need to be met to solve them. And in my view, the pressures on local authorities with their day-to-day business with old people, young people and whatever are pretty immense. And if this is meant to be a kind of 25-year view, I think probably to have a kind of vehicle that does have some statutory powers that is in a longer cycle than local elections and doesn't have to look at 70% of its budget going on social care.
Yeah, of course.
And having its skill base in infrastructure and land and development probably makes sense.
And how would local accountability be kind of tied in with that? So I think that's just a concern when development corporations are set up, is ensuring local people are not left out of the process. I assume that would be bedded in right at the start, is the local community involvement.
I mean, partly there's a sort of statutory process for engagement and consultation with somebody like you is very familiar with before you'd even form one. But I think it's, you know, it's really about who the board is and who, how the board's appointed and who they report to. Yeah.
One thing that can be said about Cambridgeshire is it's not short of local government and layers of bureaucracy. So we've got Cambridge, South Cams, the county, we've got the mayor, we've got the Greater Cambridge Partnership, we've now got yourself as well. How are you finding that to navigate? Oh, and also we have unitaries and a mayor who's going to have spatial development strategy powers as well. So how are you finding yourself knitting into all of this? Because I think if you're starting from scratch, you wouldn't kind of invent the government structure which is currently in place in Cambridgeshire, but it is what it is. We are where we are. So how are you navigating that?
I don't think it's unparalleled in the country, but it is pretty intense, and there are particular wards where you could have all four tiers of politics in your house, so to speak. I think we just have to have an open conversation over the next year as the evidence emerges.
Commercial versus housing. I think, again, is your remit, do you see it as unlocking housing sites? Or I think earlier you alluded to kind of the jobs and the houses, which are they, I suppose they are, again, in parallel. But is your remit from government to focus on helping to deliver the 1.5 million homes, or is it to assist for commercial growth? What's their priority for you?
So Homes England is definitely there for the 1.5 million homes, but also is involved in regeneration in towns that involves jobs. I think it would be wrong for Cambridge to be asked to take more homes than in a sense went with the jobs. The Cambridge leadership has done astonishingly. The Cambridge has been growing at about 1.7% new homes relative to stock, whereas most of the South East has been about half of that. So, you know,
it's pulled its weight, hasn't it, Cambridge and South Grams?
To the existing leadership. I mean, I'd probably see it at different levels. There's the overall level where you've got to sort out transport and water and health services and be sure there's enough new schools and so on. And then there's the level of individual blocks. And the reason I say individual blocks is it would be insane to do most of this by 50 houses here and 100 there and 200 there. You know, most of this should be 10 master plans that each of them can take employment and housing and education and leisure and public open space, lots of public open space, landscape and so on. So some of those will more naturally, because of their location, be, you know, maybe 80% about housing and 20% about jobs and amenities like schools and doctors, surgeries and parks. And some of them will be the other way around. But I think as far as possible, if you do them at the scale where they can be mixed use, you make them better to live in and more sustainable. Because you know, if you build 100 houses on a cul-de-sac where there isn't a bus stop, everybody comes and goes by a car. There's no other choice. Maybe a bike occasionally. If you build 5,000 homes and 5,000 jobs and two schools, you know, you can probably cut 70% of the car journeys because children can walk to school or whatever. I think for me, almost the beginning point of community and sustainability is that 90% of kids can walk to a primary school.
Yeah. I mean, is there an argument that you could get speedier delivery by kind of the village extension, the 100 homes here, the 200 homes there, rather than the new town and the necessary infrastructure that comes to it? Because a lot of villages around Cambridge are quite well connected to various forms of public transport. Do you think that's...
I think the 100 here and 100 there, which is to an extent how most planning in the southeast has historically been, is kind of the worst of all things. It puts stress on every village. It brings very little amenity.
Yep.
So I think, you know, my view is that either it should be in a large set piece that brings its own schools and doctor surgeries, or it should be more actually saying to a village, if you're afraid your village school will close because there aren't enough children, or if you would like one to open and you actually would like several hundred homes, tell us and we will see if we can kind of make that happen. But if you're a relatively small village and you'd rather be left alone, then I think our job should be to leave you alone.
No, indeed, it's interesting because we are seeing primary schools close across across the region with the lack of numbers in villages around Cambridgeshire. The larger settlements obviously begs the question about infrastructure and where it's going to be funded. We had the comprehensive spending review last week. How much money do you think the government can invest, and put too much on the spot here to say, but you know, it's clearly going to be a lot of investment needed to unlock the scale of developments you're talking about, financially, in the size of homes. This is new road junctions. It's an awful lot. Do you think the appetite's there from the government to focus in on Cambridgeshire to that extent?
I think sort of part of my job and my experience and background is, you know, being a developer of large schemes is partly about having vision and patience and some diplomacy and some senses of what a good place is. But it is also very much about being able to raise long-term money. And there's a kind of gap in the world of investment in property. If something is an up-and-let building, you haven't got to take planning risk, you haven't got to take building risk, you haven't got to take land assembly risk, you haven't got to take tenancy risk, investors will actually accept a very moderate return, you know, maybe 7 or 8% per annum. If they're told, go and assemble the land, go and spend 3 years and £5 million on a planning application and you might not get permission, they'll probably say, well, I'll only do that if I get 20% per annum. Yep. But actually, they won't do it anyway. It's too messy. Yeah, yeah. So I think part of the role of the growth company is to de-risk the planning and the land assembly so that it can package things. And I think at that point, there is not unlimited, but there is loads of institutional private sector money that would be pleased to be invested in both commercial and residential in Cambridge.
And also land value tax, potentially. I mean, Crossrail was added to developers' Section 106 bills for a number of years. I don't know if it's still around today, but it's for a long time. Is for scope for the private sector paying in the uplift of value of the land to actually pay for this?
There's lots of different ways for the private sector to pay. You know, one is the Section 106 obligations. Mm-hmm. One is SIL. One is special tariffs like the wars for Crossrail.
Yep.
Another is the government acquiring the land early at a kind of bulk discount rate, sorting out the planning and the infrastructure and moving in on at a retail investment rate. So I think, you know, on a case-by-case basis, all of those will be used.
Yeah. So in 2050, what would good growth for Cambridge look like?
I've said it on a couple of platforms that it annoys me that when you say to most sort of urbanists and architects in England, you know, what should I go and see? They want to send you to Sweden or Germany or Holland.
Yeah.
And so part of my sense of what good growth will be is if in 2050 people are told, you know, from all over the world, you've got to go and see Cambridge.
Yeah.
And what you judge it by, I think, is the... the kind of well-being in the air, the number of people in the street, the number of people kind of outside. You know, when I visit King's Cross now as a visitor, I'm always thrilled at how many people are just sitting on a wooden bench we made or a stone bench we made or having an ice cream or having a coffee or watching their children play in the fountains or doing yoga on the steps that lead down to the canal. Mm-hmm. They like being there. Yeah. And if Cambridge is a place where the people who live and work there like being there, the best PhD from around the world in biomedicine thinks, I'd rather go to Cambridge than Silicon Valley or Geneva, then job's done.
One of the aspects of Cambridge that many people aren't aware of is people see the university, the life sciences and the jobs, but there's actually... It's actually quite a divided city in some respects in terms of wealth and not, and actually has some of the poorest wards in the country within it, which not many people are aware of. How is the Growth Company going to try and ensure that as Cambridge grows, people living in a city are available to access the jobs which are created, the skills, the training? Is that very much part of your focus?
Yeah. Cambridge is a divided city, and there is much more deprivation than I'd imagined. Mm-hmm. I think it's in part because there was more of a kind of industrial past, and most of the industrial jobs have gone. And with the sort of winding down of the Marshalls businesses, more jobs have gone. 300 people were made redundant last year. So I think in many ways, training... Mm-hmm. Is going to be essential to the success of the whole programme, because whether it's training to make sure that everybody is included and there's good jobs for everybody, or whether it's training in order to find people to work in the labs, or whether it's training to find enough people to build the buildings, we cannot sort of let the resource of local people be lost. They need to be in the workforce, contributing to the growth. And B, it's just unfair that they aren't included. And I think part of that is a sort of transport, physical accessibility.
Yeah.
I was astonished when I went to the Abbey Ward, which is one of the more deprived wards, and met the wonderful people who run Abbey People, which is a community association. The time it takes from somebody there to get to Adam Brooks, you know, I could probably cycle to Adam Brooks from there in 20 minutes, and it can take well over an hour to get there by public transport. So, you know, those social needs are something we must also help address.
I guess it's also tying in with the sixth forms and the colleges, people, institutions like ARU, to ensure that, you know, the skills which are needed as we move forward, not looking backwards but moving forwards, are there for young people in Cambridge. Peter, thank you very much for your time today. Best of wishes. And we look forward to seeing the report when it comes to space development strategy when it comes out in 2026.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure.